This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 410, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see.
Hello, welcome to the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 410. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and joining me are Josh Flanagan.
Hello.
And Paul Montgomery.
Hello.
We are iFanboy. We like comics. And every week we read a bunch of comics, or in this case, a few comics. One of us picks the best book they read. We call that the Pick of the Week. We talk about it on the podcast, along with other books of the week, other topics of interest, and other goofy nonsense. Before we get to the show, word of caution. This is going to be a review show, so there'll be spoilers in case you hadn't heard about someone dying or not dying in the saga this week. So if you haven't read your books yet, pause the show, come back. Everybody will be happier. And this week, on this very special fifth week in comics.
Well, that's funny. It's fifth week, and we're talking about a fifth something else later. That's kind of cool.
Josh had the pick.
I did. Well, it didn't take me a long time to read comics this week. there were a small number of them. In fact, I had finished here's a little behind the scenes that I had finished my books, and I wrote to you two, and I was like, here's what I read. Is there anything else I can read?
not so much, no.
No, you're like, no, we read that many and less. I was like, all right, so I tried. Because there wasn't a whole hell of a lot. However, what I ended up with, I decided to make the pick of the week, Superior Spider-Man Team Up, I guess one shot, number one, whatever. Yeah. This is part 3 of 3. Paul, you made the Hulk?
It was the first one. I made the all new X-Men special number one. And then special number one.
Yeah. The titles are the characters who were in it, basically. Yeah. It's the all new X-Men, the Hulk, and
it's the arms of Dr. Octopus storyline.
But it's three parts of one storyline. And honestly, if I was a consumer, I would find that confusing because the covers are not like it would be hard to follow the thread. And each time that a second issue has come out of this, I have missed it. Or I would almost miss it. You know
what I mean? I hadn't read my books yet. And when you said this was the pick, I was like, what the hell is that? And I was like, oh, okay.
Exactly.
All right.
Because I'm not going to necessarily get the Superior Spider-Man.
I didn't even read it because I thought it was that book you guys like, that team up book. That's Superior Spider-Man book. So I didn't even read this one.
Superior Foes of Spider-Man.
That's a whole other thing.
But, so,
yeah.
This is the story that brings together the Hulk or Banner, the all-new X-Men and Superior Spider-Man and a little fun adventure. It's all been written by Mike Costa, so it's definitely one through line that goes through these three specials. And this is the culmination. This has been fun all the way through. The artist this time out was Michael Dionysius? Whatever. I'm not going to work here anymore. Anyway, I was a big fan of the art and the choices on this book, to just make this kind of a a fun book and a different style than you expect from, I guess, a Marvel comic. Mm-hmm. And it fit really well. I liked how it's almost like it was like an indie comic cartoon, like what I think of as old cartoony indie comics.
Yes.
Like dots for eyes and, not huge dramatic poses, but more regular cartooning.
I mean, like Hank McCoy in this, young Hank McCoy has got like the big glasses and they're like just huge oversized, like owl glasses. And, it's drawn like maybe an indie relationship comic.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing, like maybe kind of like an Alex Robinson kind of a book, something like that.
Yeah. Instead of, say, like a ton of muscles and straps and stuff, there's it's all very line based and shape based. So like all the characters have a different different shape to them. You know,
and
like
what's cool about it is that when they get into action sequences, Mike Costa's really good with like battle tactics. Like taking all of the characters that he has and they're fighting some robots in this issue. What do we do to get, or they're falling, you know, from an exploding helicopter and they're free falling. And what are we going to do with the limited time that we have? And you're Jean Grey, you have, telepathy, you should be able to do this and blah, blah, blah. And it's really thoughtful, like when you have all of these characters together in this combination, how can these powers coalesce?
And he made it difficult on himself, because as you know, these are the all new X-Men. They don't know how to do squat yet. So he's like, Jean, do this, and she's like, I don't want to do that. Okay, you do this. I don't want
to
do that.
Yeah, like Scott, right, use fine, Scott, I'll use your it. Optic beams to stop your descent. Oh, he's passed out.
Yeah.
So he can
And you have sort of the cathartic moment where Superior Spider-Man puts the octopus arms back on again, and, and he takes care of it. Also, symbolically and literally destroying the arms.
Yeah.
Interesting. This was just it was a fun book. It was one of those things where, we've known about Mike Costa for years, doing work over on Cobra for IDW, and it has always been interesting to me that he hasn't really popped up that much in quote unquote mainstream comics. Right. He had a series over at the DC relaunch that lasted, I don't think he was on it for about 7 pages. the Blackhawks book, and they were like,
okay. Yeah.
But dude's got a lot of talent. And what I like is that it would be really easy. I'm gonna do some comparison of writers, but another guy sort of in that same vein would be something like Nathan Edmondson, who's sort of known for doing sort of gritty and militaristic sort of cold operational kind of things. Mm-hmm. And so when he's done books for Marvel and DC, they've sort of felt like that. This doesn't feel anything like G.I. Joe Cobra. No. Other than the fact that the sort of relationships in it are very strong, the sort of way that the people interact and the voices. That's always been a strength of G.I. Joe Cobra, but has a very different tone, and it shows me that he's got a lot of range. Mm-hmm. So I was really impressed by that, and I think that he's a guy that they give him some more books to do, and it feels like he's done really well with this. This feels to me like Marvel's version of a tryout book, and he sort of nailed it. And I'm guessing we're going to see more from him. And if you didn't listen to us about G.I. Joe Cobra, watch out for this guy's name, because he's gonna probably do some good stories.
Yeah, get this guy on some team books. Yep. Teen and team books probably would be a good combination for him. But it's fun. Without it, there's no subtraction to the action.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And it's all the set classic pieces, it's great.
It's very classic superhero-y, and I feel like it has a sort of light edge. And there's going to be a question about this later in the audience questions. But this is the kind of book that I see come out of Marvel that I'm not seeing come out of DC right now. And if you look at sort of the editor credits at the beginning, this is Jordan White and Nick Lowe as associate and sort of main editor on it. These are the guys who do Deadpool. These are the guys who've done other really good, fun books. Nick Lowe is, of course, he's the big X-Men editor, but he's the guy behind the Fury series, the Fury Max series that was the greatest thing on Earth. Like for me right now, those are guys that are doing great work at Marvel, and faring really fun, cool little projects through. And because of the way that this was set up, it's very easy to have it go under the radar. It's a one-shot. It's, the titles aren't the same all the way across it. It seems it's outside of whatever the regular story is. But it fits in perfectly with that stuff. It doesn't take away from it. And if you like these characters, it's really like combined all the things that are good about Superior Spider-Man, which I stopped reading, all new X-Men, and the whatever the Hulk is, whatever his adjective is.
Incredible
now.
Hulk.
It's not incredible.
Indestructible Hulk.
Indestructible Hulk. There you go.
Yeah. No, but that's the thing too. I was thinking about it, like, if this was just a miniseries with its own name, would we have looked at it necessarily?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I would have looked at it.
I hope so.
We only looked at it because Paul accidentally bought it, thinking it was related to the All New X-Men story.
I actually read it before he did that. Right. I think I got it on accident. But again, like, it was all accidental.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how many parts were there? Three or four?
Just three.
So two out of three were picks this week, which would tell you, the quality of this miniseries.
Yeah, and on another week, the second installment could have been a pick of the week too. That was very good.
They were all equally good, and I think, I don't know, they're just, if you enjoy these characters, like, he got what was really cool about the current incarnations of these characters. Because one thing I don't want to even give Marvel credit for, but they've found a way to make these characters, which had become for me largely stale, somewhat interesting. In the same way that when they got rid of Bruce Wayne for a while and it was Dick Grayson, it was like, oh, good, I can hang out with Batman, but it feels different. And this has been a way, what with the new sort of iteration of Banner, well, he's the one who's changed the least, but, the younger X-Men, and then, I can't believe that Otto Octavius as Spider-Man works, but it does. And
it
I think, especially in the story. This story has captured, for me, the understanding of the justification for why he wants to be a hero better than any of the other stuff I've read about it.
Mm-hmm. There's also a really great moment at the end of this where Banner is talking to young Scott Summers, mm-hmm. and Scott's like, why haven't you, like, killed yourself? He's like, why haven't you, like, all the terrible things you've done, why haven't you ever, ended it? And he's like, well, I've certainly thought about it, but then I think about all the things that I can accomplish as a scientist, and I'm working on this, this water filter thing in Africa, and I'm atoning, and you have to balance that out. And it's a great understanding of that character psychology. And, you never really think of what's the conversation that Bruce Banner would have with Scott Summers, let alone young Scott Summers, and their commiseration. And so I thought that was really good. That was really, really sharp.
Yeah. I also, in that same way, that the next page is Otto thinking, well, geez, what if I went back and I guided my younger self? Mm-hmm. And he sees himself as Dr. Octopus with the Avengers. Then he's like, no, that time's just going to... He's smart enough to know time's going to mess that up. Or traveling in time is never a good idea. Like, you're going to screw something else mm-hmm. up. So he decides against it and just decides to move forward.
Yeah, somehow the old Captain America is wearing this stupid new costume.
he will do that.
While you were talking, I downloaded this, and the art is wonderful.
Isn't it?
It's totally like, it looks like more, you'd look, find it home in Box Office Poison or something, a book like that. Which is, I think, part of the miracle of the series has been they put really indie-minded artists on it, but didn't really market it that way, had them do the story, and it works out really well.
The covers are lies. Let's just get it out there. But for me, and I'm 100% not the majority on this kind of thing, but for me, like, this is the, I love this art. This art, nice, flat, solid colors on stuff, it's just cartooning, and that's great. And I think, like, it's constructed well, the storytelling's good, he's got his splash pages where you need to, it's got all of the things that comics can do. It'd be fun to see more work from this dude.
Well, if you want to talk about more art, that's pretty wonderful. This was the week that the latest Sandman comic came out, which... Now, granted, I'm not as plugged in as I used to be, but I didn't feel like this really hit with any kind of seismic force. But
I feel like Karen Berger being gone from Vertigo undercut this to a certain extent.
The Sandman Overture number one from Neil Gaiman and J.H. Williams III. And it was mostly two-page spreads.
Yeah.
And just, wonderful.
The big old gatefold in here. I got this in print, and I was like, I'm really glad that I have this physically, because... navigating this digitally would, I think it really defeats the purpose on this, especially this kind of issue. That said,
in what way?
I have no idea what this is. And it should be noted, I didn't read Sandman. So
thing. This is, I did read Sandman. I've read it a couple times. I was sort of made the de facto Sandman guy, even though it's never really been one of my favorite series. I think it's very good. I have all the books, I've read them. This is the question that says, that asks again, as in comics, we try over and over, can you go home again? Can you know, we asked, can James Robinson come back to Sandman? And he did in sort of Starman. Sideways Man with Starman with the I just blanked completely. The Shade miniseries. Right. And that actually worked out really well. This as a first issue worked out pretty well. This as a first issue, other than having really stunning art and feeling familiar, it didn't really – not much happened, so it's hard to say. Right. It starts off spending a lot of time with the Corinthian, who is one of the more memorable and sort of scary characters from the first series. And I was instantly like, ooh, Corinthian, that's terrible. He's got teeth in his eyes, which is enough of a description to make him scary.
Mouth eyes.
But we mouth eyes, of course.
And you get POV shots from inside those mouths.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
You get, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, J.H. Williams III, there's, you know what you're going to get. There's not much to complain about. It's always very impressive. His style sort of whips around, and we get to see a lot of different stuff. You know, the characters all sound like the characters because Neil Gaiman has that down. But basically, you know, if you were to ask me what the plot of it is, he has a meeting with the Corinthian, asks him to go do something. He asks him, he's going to unmake him, I guess. But then he gets called away. He gets called away before that can happen. And he shows up to some sort of calling. And there are a bunch of other Sandmen there. And that's where we left off.
Are those the Endless?
No.
Those are all Sand. Those are different versions of Sandmen.
Oh, okay.
All right. We were previously led to believe that the reason that there are different versions of Sandman is that because he's the Lord of Dreams, people see him in different ways, and he projects himself in different ways, but it's all sort of the same God, but God isn't even the right word. It's even bigger than that. So these are all different versions. There's the Cat Sandman, and there's Daniel in there, and there's different sort of renderings of him. So
you know what my favorite character was?
Which?
It'd be George Portocullis.
Oh, yeah. No, I knew you'd like
that. I was like, that's for me.
yeah, absolutely. So we don't know. He seems to be being confronted by his himself.
Right.
And it's very much it's almost a cold open.
Well, it's funny because I'd only read the trades for that video show we did a long time ago. I don't remember how long ago that was, in 2008 probably. And so I hadn't read Sandman since then, but I really did like, and I didn't really love it, but I did really like it all the way through. And it wasn't always traditionally storytelling. You know, lot of game and stuff is just sort of atmospheric and experiential stuff. And I just love the way he writes so much. And yeah. I don't know if it's because I can hear his voice, and his voice is so amazingly pleasant.
Yeah.
That when I read it, I hear him saying it, and that's just makes me happy. But I did like this quite a bit. But I mean, like you said, I couldn't tell you what the story was necessarily, but I did like the way it was written, and I liked the characters. You know, the Corinthian's a scary character. I've always liked, you know, Sandman, however you want to call him.
It's too early to judge.
Exactly.
If you think about, we all read Sandman, if we read it at all, in trade form. So I never had to read it in issues.
Right.
So, and then in that time, since Sandman's been over, Neil Gaiman has become immensely famous and successful, but he's a novel writer. He writes long books. So to compress him into judging things by doing it in issues, I think is not the right way to look at it. So this is going to be a story, I think, that isn't really going to be able to be judged until we've read the whole thing. So I'm going to keep reading Sandman Overture, obviously. It's got all the marks of quality, something that's going to be there. I think that if you have never read Sandman and you're going to start reading here, it's going to fall a little flat for you.
There's a bit of a barrier to entry, but the prose is lovely. So it does make me want to go back and revisit the early stuff.
Dude can
revisit the early stuff for the first time.
And it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it.
And I should say, I've read and enjoyed several of his novels, so I'm a Gaiman fan, but...
Yeah, and you get J.H. Williams III. I mean, I'd rather have him on this than some Batwoman.
It's a really good pairing.
It is,
you know,
it is.
That's
although I did notice they made him less sort of like dreamy as a character. You know, like he had a big the Sandman character had a big appeal towards young women when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of in that Edward of Twilight way, and here he doesn't really have that sort of.
He looks a lot
idle, dreamy.
He looks a lot like he did in the first issue of the other Sandman, really.
Right.
He changes. I mean, that's the thing.
Sure.
And I mean, obviously, like, that's going to be part of the story. The part of the story is how many different versions of him there are and what that means.
Sure.
He reminds me of Hermes from Wonder Woman.
I don't think he doesn't have a mean streak like that.
I mean, physically.
Yeah, no, you're right.
With the face.
Yeah.
So this week we also had Fox number one from Archie Comics. And this is notable because it's written and drawn by Dean Haspiel with dialogue by Mark Waid. So Mark Waid didn't exactly write the plot, but he did script the plot. And also John Workman on letters, which is also...
I saw that. You know, you're a comic book nerd, and you're like, ooh, Workman.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
I didn't love this.
I didn't make it.
Yeah.
I started to read it, and I was like, no.
It feels much more simplistic in a way that something like Archie, Afterlife with Archie, doesn't, where that feels very, very much all ages, but in a sophisticated way. This felt very sort of simple. So it was difficult. I was looking forward to it. I wasn't really, really excited for it, but I was looking forward to it because it's interesting. I did like these Red Circle Comics characters. They're all these Golden Age superheroes that Archie is bringing back.
What's the character like? What's the setup?
The Fox is a journalist who put on the costume to find where the action is.
Okay.
And that's really...
You've
I mean,
been there.
You know, that's really what it is. Will Patton was a photojournalist who couldn't seem to find the story, so he became a crime fighter to make the story come to him. And he's kind of like Spider-Man in that sense. He goes out and creates the story and then reports on it, which seems unethical, but we'll just ignore that. You know, in this issue, he goes to investigate this skin cream or something.
Every time with the skin cream.
What does this woman do? She does something with... she's a magazine editor, like one of the women's fashion magazine editors. And it turns out she's actually a demon. And she's kind of scary looking with a scary face. And then they fight for the whole issue. And then, you know, it's fine. It just was very simple. Which is good. I mean, you know, if it's aimed at a younger audience.
Does it seem like it's going to be like an episodic kind of thing or more like ongoing arcs?
Well, at the end, there's another character shows up, which, and this tells you how much I retained from the story because it wasn't really that interesting. Another character shows up and that's going to continue on with that story. So it looks like that particular episode is over, but this new character shows up at the end. It's, you know, sort of like connective tissue to the next thing. So it's a little more, it's not episodic in a way that a regular Archie comic is episodic, but it looks like this caper is over. So I did kind of enjoy the backup story a little bit more, which is actually written by Haspiel entirely, I think, which was where the Fox goes to buy a camera at a pawn shop and there's trouble. But because he wants to buy a real camera for his son because he's a photojournalist and he wants... there's a whole spiel. There's a lot of old man stuff in here. Like the whole spiel about, you know, when you can take a million pictures with your digital camera, it doesn't lose its specialness when you have to find that one photo because you don't have a lot of film. It's harder, which is not wrong. But
I was one of the last photo classes at my university where you had the option for physical film versus digital.
Right.
I was digital anyway, but
because
I happen to have a digital camera, so I used
when my wife started shooting, she would give people the option. You want film or whatever, but it costs a lot more. So, and then now it's just gone.
So, like, yeah, I mean, it wasn't that great. I was kind of sad that I didn't love
it. I tried. I read like a few, and I was like, this feels like when I tried. What's that other thing that Wade did for Dynamite?
Oh yeah, he did Green Hornet.
It was like that. I was like, all right, you know, I don't have to like everything Wade does.
No. And you know, it is what it is. There are some comics for this is aimed at a squarely younger audience, which is fine.
Totally.
They're allowed to have comics.
They should have them.
So, yeah.
And Haspiel is a good artist.
I was sad because I do like what Archie does in general. But I
for a little bit, I thought, am I going to have the first Archie figure? No. That's never happened, right? That's the thing.
No, I never had one. It would have been Afterlife of Archie. Jerk.
Yeah.
Swamp Thing Annual number 2.
I don't make the schedule.
I know. Swamp Thing Annual number 2, which is another issue written by the main writer of Charles Soule.
Charles Soule minute.
And I really like this a lot. I love his exploration of the history. I love Dinosaur, Swamp Thing. I want to see a whole story about that one. This was this was Empire Strikes Back. This was something in the cave with Yoda.
this is whatever the Geoff Johns effect is, which is like, hey, what if we made a bunch of different colored rings? And that's sort of gone out into everything, you know, and like, well, what if we have a bunch of different swamp things? And I love like the fat colonial Burgess swamp thing. I could what a wonderful design that is.
I
think it's really interesting that I enjoyed Scott Snyder's Swamp Thing a lot. I thought it was good. Mm-hmm. But I think that Charles is maybe better suited for the character.
I think the hold on the mythology is interesting that he has, and I think his is a more traditional approach, which is kind of what I was looking for in anyway.
Yeah,
and this is not superhero Swamp Thing, which is what Snyder's Swamp Thing was. This is like Avatar, doomed Avatar of the Green Swamp.
Really getting into the lore of
The thing that I really liked about this is it's interesting that I really like the character of the green, which didn't used to be the green. It was the parlin of trees, and it's something that's always been around. So it's not a new thing. I like that it's not human, and you're continually going back to that. Like they don't care about humans. That's not a thing. And because he is actually Alec Holland, and the Swamp Thing that we read from Alan Moore primarily was not Alec Holland. And there's a reintroduction to that and a confrontation of that in this. I really enjoyed that. And I like the conflict that's going on there. Alec's mad. He's like, he wants this thing, but he doesn't. But he's stuck in the middle of this. And you know, we got to meet the old ellipses swamp thing we haven't seen for a while.
I like the conflict of, you know, he thinks his job is to protect the humans. They're like, fuck the humans. Protect the trees and the grass and everything. And it's you know.
It's do
what you have to do to protect the plant life. And he's like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to kill people just to protect trees.
You know, I don't know where it was brought from, but it's very reminiscent of the Ents, you know, the Lord of the Rings, Tolkien sort of, you know, they move at a different speed. Their concerns are different. Their way that they look at the world is different. So there's a note of that in here, which I like. I like that the avatars have all tried to regain, like they've all tried this some little weird way to hold on to whatever their version of humanity was.
Mm-hmm.
The art by going back to the beginning.
There's a couple of guys in
art. Oh, was it? Was it a few? It was great. It was really like this is one of those things where Javier Pena and then Kano, like they were just allowed to play with the. How to, you know, these plant creatures build themselves and all these different versions of it. And it was fun to look at his sort of the palatial manor house, you know, made of plants. And he flies away on one of those little helicopter things. And,
yeah, it's not like Willy Wonka. It's like,
yeah.
You know, like I'm stepping off this barge and I'm getting on a plant and he's going to take me away like a helicopter. It was, this is exceptionally fun. Mm-hmm. And we were talking earlier and we're going to talk again about DC's fun quotient, but this was fun, not in the overt way that I think you'd expect, but I just thought the imagination made it really fun and interesting. And, you know, we saw all these different kinds of swamp things I thought they were presented in a fun way. And I really enjoyed this
issue. I think if there's anybody out there who read, say, Charles's first issue or two of Swamp Thing, where he didn't even find him, but I don't think he quite had it. Like it was the one in Metropolis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think if you like Swamp Thing and you're like, that wasn't quite it. I think if you come back and you read through these, you're going to, I think he's got it. You know, I think he's sort of picked up on that thread and run with it. And these are you know, the issues are getting stronger as he goes through them.
Yep, I really liked it.
So
Paul,
yeah,
Paul,
Battle of the Atom number 2,
yeah,
culmination of the event. Speaking of multiple artists,
ouch.
Okay, so this is Jason Aaron and Esad Ribic, which sound great. Love those two together. I don't think this was the best choice
for
Esad Ribic.
Well,
it starts off with Esad Ribic, and
there's an inker on here that just obliterates his art.
Yeah,
in Thor, there wasn't an inker.
Well, the other thing is that just tonally, the story, and Jason Aaron is playing with, you know, the way that Bendis plays with these characters in the dialogue, and it's very quippy and jokey, and Esad Ribic isn't that artist.
Right.
That's not what he's great for. And the weird thing, so the issue sort of morphs into Giuseppe Cumincoli comes in and does some fill-in stuff, but the thing is, the stuff that Cumincoli does is what Esad Ribic should have been doing, is the scene... Yeah. With the with Zorn, and like maybe gonna turn into the Phoenix or something, and it gets really like larger than life, and I was like, if Ribic was gonna do any pages in this issue, it should have been those pages.
For a story that I've loved, right. I thought this really fell on its face at the end,
and
not in the typical way. I thought it was because of the creative team choices were just. Pretty much a big misstep.
It was just a mismatch, and it's sort of like you think like you can never go wrong with Esad Ribic, and there are some beautiful images in here, but yeah, I think that the inking isn't quite right, and I don't exactly know how to articulate that, but it doesn't look as, not that it was polished in Thor, because we always talk about how it was so rough hewn, but
it looks like a heavy handed inker in the, and I don't want to. I don't know that this is right. It just looked like the more of the inking style came through than the art style.
Yes.
And it doesn't look like the Thor art at all.
He collected that shit.
Yeah, only in little places does it look like the Thor. And the thing is, it just...
But even if it look like the Thor stuff, that's the wrong choice for this book.
This has been a series that has been exemplified by a fantastic art. And I thought, what a bizarre thing to do for the final issue.
Also this particular storyline, having characters from the past, present, and future having inconsistent art is really problematic because which version of the character is that? And some characters might be slightly off model and stuff, and you can't tell by their expressions. So the story, I mean, it's pretty good stuff. Other than the fact that, you know, you were talking about Tolkien earlier. There's like 7 epilogues to this story.
they give each book its own epilogue, so that each writer from each book gets to write where those characters are going next, which makes sense in a crossover like this. I actually thought that was okay. It's just even at that point, they get to use their regular artists for that, which was good. It just before that, the culmination of this great story, just by that point, I was already annoyed that I wasn't happy with the issue.
Yeah, so there's some great moments in this issue. And I liked some of that epilogue stuff. I liked the idea of seeing Jubilee's kid, that she's sort of adopted, all grown up as sort of the future Iron Man kind of character, and interacting with her, and saying that you sort of get this together, and it's a little offset by they're still playing with this vampire stuff. It's like, come on. Nobody likes the vampire stuff.
According to that, it's never going to stop, so...
Yeah, he's like, you get better, but like you're still a vampire. Like she just deals with it. But I mean, and you know, there's great stuff with Wolverine and Cyclops. I don't know that I entirely buy Kitty exiting. That feels sort of like a contrivance of the plot. Like this is where the story's going next.
And joining Scott.
Joining Scott. Yeah, I was like, I don't entirely buy that. I mean, I know there were beats to set that up earlier in this crossover, but. It just feels like this is what the next status quo is going to be, so therefore I'm mad at you.
I do kind of like the idea that they're not really explaining why the original X-Men can't go back. It's just, well, time won't let them. Let's move on.
Yeah, and they sort of the declaration really is that we're of this time. We're where we belong. And I think today online just popped up the previews for their new costumes that they're going to get. I kind of like the old costumes. I just kind of like them running around.
Because they're classic.
They are classic, and these are very not classic.
They're classic for a reason.
Right.
I'm talking like Peter Venkman because I just watched Ghostbusters.
No, but so it's like I think the art is sort of a problem. And then just I think it feels slightly rushed at the end ferry them off to their own books. So... otherwise, I think all the issues leading up to this were fantastic, and I was ready to call it, you know, my favorite Marvel event in a while.
I feel like they created a lot out of this, a bunch of different X-Men teams, a bunch of different future versions, things like that. And at the end, you have all these neat things that you created, but the hard part is making that work.
Right.
And it sounds to me like,
what are they wearing?
Yeah.
I just looked up the preview.
I saw the preview.
I hadn't seen it yet.
When I saw Beast, I didn't know that that was Beast. I thought that that was Scott. Yeah, and then I looked behind him and, okay, well, that's clearly Scott.
Why? Oh.
Yeah, they're pretty.
I'm going to look at this. Hang on. Well, don't hang on. Keep talking.
They're sort of like Legion of Superhero costumes.
Defeat from the Jaws of Victory kind of situation here.
Yeah, so just this weird, this weird. It's like the gymnastics team, like the girl who's really good at doing the vaults, and then she goes up to do that last one, and she like just stumbles at the end. Like that's what this felt like. It was like it was doing so well, and then. This art thing was a problem. I mean, and even if it worked out with Eastside Ribic, it's not the right choice.
Yeah, it just wasn't. I was pretty bummed. In a week when I didn't have tons of comics, like I had like 10 or less, this is the one I was the most looking forward to. And oof.
It was
rough.
Like Alex Ross doing a Scotty Young baby variant cover. Like, you don't mix those two. Like,
I don't know. I kind of want to see that now.
Yeah. but anyways,
Josh, tell the people how they can help.
You can help by going to ifanboy.com/Amazon. You want more?
Yes. No. Just embellish a little bit.
I was looking at this art. No, anyway, one of the ways that you can help iFanboy and keep these podcasts going and keep the proverbial lights on is to make all of your internet purchases that you can through our Amazon link, which costs you nothing. And it does nothing but help us. And you can buy, I believe we've done some funny bits on here about the different kinds of things you can buy.
Right.
But there are also there's lots of sort of regular non-funny things that you could also buy through there.
Buy a PS4.
You could do that. That would be great. Or
we
perhaps
would like that in all the games.
A large television. But what I'm saying is that if you have a large purchase of some kind, just run it through there. And if it costs you maybe a little more than maybe with somewhere else, maybe that's worth it to you.
You know what? I think it's time to upgrade to a 4K TV. It's not too early. It's never too early.
I have decided to stop keeping up with that kind of technology so that I don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Because my TV, which is ostensibly a very nice LCD TV, but it's only 46 inches and it's like 4 or 5 years old now. I'm sure there's something better.
There's like three things better.
I don't want to know. It's fine.
I'm gonna start emailing you information.
That's fine. Do that. Or you can sign up for a membership to sort of help directly monetarily help. We've reduced the sort of rates down to $3 a month or $30 a year. And that just goes directly to paying the bandwidth bills and the different sort of systems we use to keep this stuff going. And do we figure out what the link for that was?
Yes, we should put it in the script, though, from now on. Starting next week, we'll have the link.
It's on the website. You'll find it.
Yeah, it's on the website. You'll find it right there at the top. And that's one way to very directly contribute to this thing if you like it very much and find it important. It's the least you can do. No, the least you can do is nothing, and that's an option, too, I suppose.
So, damn that Brian K. Vaughan and his last page cliffhangers. In which a fan favorite character gets a knife sunk in his throat.
I think in this issue, and in this series, really, he's also stepped up with shocking opening pages. There have been famous ones that have like genitals on them. This one, you know, in particular, this is great stuff. Does this issue look different to you guys? Is there something going on?
That first page does.
There's a lot more painting in
it. It feels, I don't know, flatter than usual. Maybe a bolder inking line. I don't know. It just felt like slightly different to me than usual.
I haven't read it in such a while.
To the point that I was looking at it and trying to look at the credits and saying, "Is this a different artist aping her style?"
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly what it is, but anyways, it still looks great.
I just like that there are a lot of books with blowjobs this month.
Yeah.
this image is just all blowjobs all the time.
Saga number 8, in case we haven't.
It's actually Saga 15. I don't know why it was written that way.
Oh, Jesus. Jesus, Josh. Jesus. Saga 15.
That was a mistake carried over from somewhere else. But none of these people had to know that.
Sex number 8, meanwhile, did come out. This was the culmination of the first story arc. In fact, it's called Culminational, which I didn't even realize until I opened it. So this is the first arc, which will you'll find in the first collection, these first 8 issues. And this was the orgy issue. And yes, it was.
Yeah, but just like the rest of the series, like, this poor dude.
No, I think I find what is going on with this main character fascinating. And it was such, you know, if you've been reading along, he is the retired Batman character for the city. And I was just hanging out with somebody who works on this book, and they were calling them characters by the Batman names. So I'm going to continue to do that. Batman, the retired Batman's character, he's so repressed from his old life. He doesn't know how to interact with society. He doesn't know how to have relationships. He certainly can't have sex with anyone. But
he overcomes.
He finally gets this. He finally sort of makes his peace with it in this issue, or at least seems to. And Catwoman falls asleep on him.
That was man, that's weird.
I was like, oh, you were ready. And then, you know, what are you gonna do? But I love this exploration. It's a really great drama series.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
I mean,
it's really dirty. It's really graphically dirty. But it's not about that. That's sort of the hook.
It's a culminational of one of those of that. I think we talked about this before. Yeah. That Alan Moore ideal of wanting to put sex in things. You can put violence in things. Put sex in things and not have it be pornography or at least change the difference of what pornography is. And I think it's not pornography. Right. It surface, you could look at it and be like, well, this is just fucking. But it's not. It's really interesting that you're trying to understand Bruce Wayne and Catwoman. It's easier, by the way, than saying the other names too. You're trying to understand what would make them tick. And like, he goes and he places himself in the middle of this giant orgy, much like we saw in Preacher. That's what it reminded me of. Like, this was the same party in my mind. And he's like, I don't know what to do with any of this. Instead of sort of even learning how to date regularly, like, he's going way too far, which is such a parallel to becoming a costume superhero.
Like, he's jumping the deep end of it. Like,
I don't go to the police academy or learn how to be a district attorney. I go put on a costume and beat up criminals. It's the same like line. It's fascinating.
I think if this was presented as pornography, there'd be too much fast forwarding and pausing for it to be even worthwhile.
This doesn't work in a video format.
No.
Because no one would make it.
Right.
I really thought that
I watched the first 10 minutes.
I really thought that the girl, the sort of groupie girl who goes and sleeps with the Riddler, this is awesome. We're just going to keep doing it this way. I thought she was going to die, but it's more interesting that she didn't die. I think that I really do think this is a great, because it's so non-traditional that I don't have any idea where any of this is going.
Nope.
I don't even have an inkling of it.
But it feels thought out. Like, it feels...
Oh, it's totally thought out.
It's directed. It's not just haphazard. It's intentional.
Right.
And because of that, like I said, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's really interesting.
If you're at all interested in this, the collection comes out this month, and it's called The Summer of Hard.
This is awesome.
He's just fucking with everybody with the name.
All right, Damien, Son of Batman, #1 by Andy Kubert.
What was
Kubert.
This business about?
This was a rough week for comics. I hate we don't try to harp on negative stuff. We try to highlight the books we like, but there was a lot of books this week, so we had to highlight what we read. And I don't even think I made it through this issue.
Coloring aside, like modern coloring aside, if you told me that this was like from 1993,
yeah,
I would totally believe you. Like, storytelling, art, the posing, it's all like, it's all they're just like going into posing, like posturing, pin up, you know.
This is written and drawn by Andy Kubert, and one of the things DC's doing a lot these days, and we're just trying to get to that email. We can talk about it more, but you know, they're doing a lot of stuff they did in the 90s, including writer-artists. And writer-artists are not necessarily a bad thing. I'm not one of those people that thinks they're bad, because there's certainly, you know, comics are built on writer-artists. But, you know, not necessarily every artist should be also a writer. And I thought the dialogue was really stilted. Again, I don't think anybody can really write Damien other than Grant Morrison, but this really made it
Yeah, and the other thing, I mean, I don't want to be like that, but like, it's one of those books where you're like, why? Why is this?
Right.
Why are you?
This was a future. This is a future story of sometime in the future. Damian's a little bit older. He's more of a teenager. Batman, who acting very stupid, gets blown up, and he's left to become the new Batman in the glimpse we had of him in the future in Batman 666, and so. I'm not going to
be reading. So the idea I thought it was sort of like a Elseworlds thing where, or like a what if
it kind of is. I mean, it's a future tale that's never.
Yeah. But more like if he became Batman and Batman and Bruce had died, but then the cliffhanger at the end is that Bruce is still alive.
Maybe.
Like, so what really?
Well, we don't know for sure if he's still alive. It just could be a hallucination. It could be all kinds of things.
All right. I guess so. But yeah, so. It just felt like one of my cousin's old comic books that I inherited. Like, I was like, this is not of this time. And I don't know why you're telling a Damian story now.
Well, they're trying to capitalize on the hoopla on his deaths, but you know, it's like 3 months.
Hasn't that farm sailed though? Like,
yeah, this was rough. Really rough.
Corbin!
Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven and the Red Death is a one-shot out of Dark Horse, just like The Fall of the House of the Usher, which was a pick of the week before. This is two adaptations of short Edgar Allan Poe stories in one issue, written and drawn by Richard Corbin. He's very good.
Why don't that bird leave him alone?
He's still good.
He's great. And like these were just really fun to read, and they looked great, and they were whimsical, and they were timeless, and you know, like he captured all of the things that make these stories from Poe creepy without sort of just illustrating the text, basically. You know, like he did comics out of them. I mean, I thought his you know, telling of the Raven was great in such a short, quick amount of time. Like, he completely nailed it. And if like you read that or something and you never understood it, like, this will tell you what it is. And this could have been a pick of the week. I didn't have much to say about it. Like, this was great. You know, it's exactly what I expected it to be. It's exactly what I wanted it to be.
That's sort of the Corbin problem. It's just like, yep, that's more great Corbin goodness. Should be in school libraries.
Yeah. The sort of way that he draws, you know, like the king and the, you know, the big chin and the giant noses and the huge breasts and just all of that stuff. I feel like I'm reading something from the 60s or 70s.
Corbin's like, I don't know, he's like Chaucer for like visuals. Like, he's like, he can take all of the foibles, and his take on evil is sort of like decadent, you know? And
if nothing else, this is like, the lighting in this thing is magnificent all the way through.
Oh yeah.
His lighting is so good, and he's doing all of it other than the lettering.
Are they doing more of these? Do we know?
I don't know. I haven't, you know. To me, they're just little surprises that come out every once in a while.
I just hope that Dark Horse is like, whatever you want to do it.
Yeah, I get the feeling they don't mind doing that.
Go to whatever.
Well, I'm going to make sure these end up at least in one school library.
Yay!
So those are the books we wanted to talk about this week. There weren't a lot. In fact, every book I bought this week we talked about, So that's how many books I read this week. But now we're going to get ahead of the game. Last month we were way behind the book of the month. This week or this month we're going to be. Right at the first week of the month, we're going to talk about Josh's book of the month for November, actually isn't out yet, but it'll be out soon.
Yeah, the book of the month is the Fifth Beatle, the Brian Epstein story by, I'm going to try not to butcher, Vivek J. Tiwari, writing and art by Andrew C. Robinson with Kyle Baker, I assume doing
a little assists. Bit of the cartoony bit.
He did the Philippines section.
Cartoon bit at the end. This comes out November 19th from Dark Horse Comics. So this is not out yet, but you can look for it.
Order this now.
You know what? I know that Connor and I are very big Beatles fans. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, we celebrate their whole catalog. But besides that, like, we've read books. We can talk about them and their history and stuff. Now, I wasn't sure where Paul fell on the spectrum.
My high school graduation gifts was the Beatles anthology on DVD.
Okay.
And I would watch that over and over again.
But have you read the anthology?
I haven't read the anthology, honestly.
I have read the anthology.
But
I also read there was a Lennon book a little while. I read that, and then I read the Beatles.
Anyway, this is the Brian Epstein story, and I think one of the interesting things to take away from this before we really dive too deeply is that, you know, he is one of the most important people in modern music history that doesn't get talked about,
right?
Really at all.
It's
and
true.
They talk about the Beatles. They talk about George Martin, mm-hmm. and Epstein gets mentioned. You know, he was their manager, but like he doesn't really get the credit for what he did. Mm-hmm. You know, which is
and
a big
for
what
being
he did.
The engine, really, because it would be very believable that there would be no Beatles, and if it weren't for Epstein. And what that means, not just to music, but to pop culture, is unfathomable.
Yeah.
So basically...
But wait, before you get into it, just to put a, you know, exclamation point on that, didn't even live as long as Jesus. He was 32 years old when he died.
It's not that he's better than
Jesus. Didn't live as long as me or Josh. I mean, it's really a very tragic story, but... And I'm not, you know...
I still have time.
You know, it's not a spoiler to say that he died young, and this is right. a story. So he, you know, it's a tragic one. It's a very tragic one. But my biggest takeaway from this story is that this is the most gorgeous book I've read in a long time.
Yeah,
maybe in years.
Now, I have heard of Andrew C. Robinson before. I looked him up, and I think I've read some stuff. But whatever it was that he was allowed to do with this,
right.
and the sort of direction that he was able to take it, it was just like. He's either doing his style or he made up a style for this book. There, every page I was – because it floats in between real history and sort of things that are going on in the mind of Epstein and going back and forth a little bit. And the color palette will change throughout it, and it's really something.
There are some pages where you just stop and you just stare at it. Like there's a moment where they're all in the back of a car. Like huddled around, it was either a contract or a map or something, and they were in the back of this car, and I mean, it was like Frazier Irving looking colors, like just really mystical looking, and it's staggering to like just go through it, and every page is like, I want that page, I want that page, I want that page.
What's really interesting about this to me is that we've talked about this a lot. That drawing actual people can be very difficult in comics, and. As soon as you see, I mean, I'm very familiar with what the Beatles look like, but as soon as you see them, like he captured not only the look of those characters, I don't know what Epstein looked like particularly well because I haven't seen him very much.
Because he hasn't talked about.
Yeah.
Martin looks like exactly, but yeah. Epstein, you know, he's slightly more handsome in this book than he is in real life. But
yeah, I caught that. As soon as the Beatles show up, you knew exactly who they were. And it isn't just the way that they looked, like he drew their posture and their body language in such a way that was extremely impressive to a person who's very familiar with the Beatles.
And that goes to Epstein too. I think he looks more handsome because that's the way he held himself and how prim and proper he sort of was.
Yeah.
Right. Although I think we should just give a high level view in that the story of this is, and if you don't know the story, it's Brian Epstein is working for his father's record store in Liverpool. He's a closet gay man. And it would at a time when it was illegal, you could get thrown in jail for being gay. And he is told he should go see this band play the Cavern, and he then discovers the Beatles, becomes their manager, and you know, helps lead them to great success.
And there's this through line of he's really enamored of the matador as like a not just as a profession or as athletes, but as a romantic ideal. And he thinks of himself sort of as like a matador kind of guiding this story along and these boys from Liverpool and creating their image. And no matter how popular they got, he always had bigger and better ideas for what they could be and what they could do. And even when they didn't, you know, they're like, okay, whatever you say. And I love that relationship because there's a couple smaller conversations, but it moves because the Beatles story, I mean, it's only, you know, a few years that
eight years
happened. Yeah.
Like
and it's just a rush. And that's what it feels like. It captures that idea that they were on this ride. And
well, I think that that one of the things that was really interesting for me is the beginning of it was I started reading it and I was like, this is good. This is interesting. And then, you know, like many things, the moment that the Beatles show up, the moment that John walks into that office and starts talking, I was like, holy crap. They nailed the voice of these guys.
Yeah.
I was kind of taken aback by sort of the banter and sort of the little, you know, the Beatle sense of humor that was made sort of popular at the time.
It's like Hard Day's Night. Like the way they speak there, like he's very clean and yeah.
Oh, there's a gag page where basically John walks in and he's like, "You're late," and he's like, "No, no, I'm John. I'm the leader. I can be late as I want." And so they're standing there and they're talking, and you know, John Lennon was an asshole. I don't know if anybody knows that, but I want that to
they
be
captured that very well in this.
Every time that you have ever like had that conversation with yourself, like, "Well, do you like to support an artist who's a dick?" Like John Lennon was awful.
He was awful to Brian Epstein too.
Brian Epstein, like the popular idea is that Epstein was in love with John, and this sort of played a part. And John would just sort of tease him about it all the time. He wasn't mean. He would
tease him along, like maybe this could happen.
Yeah,
that's my favorite scene in the book. I should say the beach scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought that was really really strong.
The point is, so like John walks in and he wants, you know, the pile of records for free. And then, you know, the next is, you know, George pops his head in and he's like, "You're late." And he's like, "No, not him, George." And then like, and then someone else is like, "Well, is Paul coming?" "Well, he's going to be late." "Yeah, but it'll be clean." You know, and they like, it's just that stuff that made people fall in love with them before you knew the music.
It was their banter. Yeah. But the thing is, Paul mentioned this is a fast paced book. It's very much kinetic, but at the same time, underneath it all is this crushing loneliness that Epstein's going through, and it's a really sad book, I think, overall. And not just because he dies, but because of the way he lived as well. You know, he's looking for love, he can't find it. He thinks he finds it. It's a con artist,
right? And they compound it that his secretary, his assistant, is in love with him.
Yeah, she wasn't a real person.
Okay, but so do you like that edition or not? If she's not real.
I didn't mind it as sort of a spirit animal to take us through the thing. I think it was a little overwrought in terms of like, we get it, you're in love with him, but it's never going to happen.
Because all of her scenes are about that.
Well, she's the idea of the life that if he just hadn't been gay, then this all would have been perfect and easy, and he wouldn't have to take a lot of drugs, and he wouldn't have to sneak around, and he wouldn't have to prove himself by doing all of this, and he would have been able to be successful, and everything would have been perfect, which, as we know, doesn't actually work out.
Yeah,
so that's why she's not real, maybe.
Yeah, they do some great stuff with repetition, like you mentioned the pills. Like he goes to see doctors wherever he is to get these pills, and they say, "And don't take it with anything else, and it'll help with the homosexuality thing, that whole problem." And you get the sense that he keeps hearing it, and it's like going in one ear and out the other. He doesn't care. My
favorite scene was the. He's just so desperate for a friend or someone that he goes to see Colonel Tom Parker, who is Elvis's manager. He thinks he's going to find someone, a kindred spirit, someone who understands his life and the difficulties. And I love that Parker is drawn occasionally as like a demon or a shark, or he's got, you know, sometimes he talks with sharp teeth and red eyes and he goes back to looking normal. And he was just a despicable human being, and he just gets crushed by that because
he's eating in every panel.
He thinks he's going to find this guy who understands his life, and they're going to be buddies, and they all admire Elvis anyway. And then Tom Parker's like, "No, I take all of Elvis's money. I get my own money. I'm stripping this guy dry, and also I'm evil."
Yeah,
he's just crushed by that.
Brian says, "You take 50% of whatever Elvis makes," and he's like, "No, he takes 50% of whatever I make. Yeah. That's the difference." And just like, get me out of here. God, this book is gorgeous. The coloring on it.
Yeah,
is amazing.
Yeah, it's really, really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised I liked it because, you know, I know the Beatles. Well, we'll see. It'll be fun. It'll be okay. And I was blown away. It was so good looking, and the sort of cartoon. There's a party at the end, and there's like, you know, it's when the Beatles are older, and there's lots of other people in the room. I think
Stones
Keith Richards is there. Yeah, and it's just like they look so. It looks so good. It captures the style of all those things, as opposed to photo, sort of cartoon renditions of characters, really.
Like, I reminded of Tom Fowler a little bit sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tom could have drawn this. You know, like that would have been really cool. It sort of feels like that. It's a great point.
And this Vivek J. Tiwari guy is, I guess, he's an entertainment producer. He's writing a screenplay of this same story. He wants to make this into a movie. This guy should have more comics.
It's a great. It's
he
a
should
great
do that too,
story
but
that needs to be told to a lot wider audience. Epstein needs to have his due, and people who know about the Beatles, you know, know about Epstein, but I think the wider audience doesn't realize how pivotal he was.
But I mean, this guy's first comic. He's great. I thought he was. I thought he was really good at just like going from scene to scene, and I mean, he doesn't hold your hand at all.
He wants to.
You're just.
Thank you very much. But there's a lot of that, by the way.
Yes, there is.
These little nods of lyrics.
Please me, and
I really liked the sequence where Moxie, the assistant, answers the phone number 9, and he says number 9, and then Yoko Ono shows up. It was just, I mean, it sort of fits the sort of mysticism that the Beatles had that anyway. That sort of like weird psychedelic kind of feeling. He manages to make it read that way, which is really quite a feat. I can't imagine I'm going to read a better OGN for quite a while.
This is the best thing I've read this year. This might be the best thing I've read since Asterios Polyp, I think. I was really gobsmacked by this one. So,
So the fifth Beatle of Brian Epstein story hits stores November 19th, around about there, depending on where you get it from. But
it's this year's Tale of Sand.
I think it's our early contender for Book of the Year, or late contender, considering it's November. But
took you a while, but we got there.
Yeah.
Wow. I was really interested because seeing the preview art, but then reading it, I couldn't put it down.
Yeah. Read it in two. I had to stop at one point.
Yeah, I read it in two chunks because I started reading it late at night and I was like, fuck, I can finish this or be screwed tomorrow. And
you can pick that up later in the month. Might we suggest our Amazon link again, ifanboy.com/Amazon. Let's do one really quick email and talk about it real quick and then we get out of here.
Yes.
Scott writes in and says, why aren't there any fun DC comics, Adventures of Superman and Batman 66 aside, those are digital. I hear people complain about this, and I see Daredevil and Hawkeye both be critically praised and commercial successes. So what the what? I can't even follow good creators at DC. Is this a problem at DC traceable to editors, writers, corporate overlords, people obsession with the dark and gritty universe since Nolan's Batman? I have no idea how I got this far. I know that there are ebbs and flows in the industry and cyclicals, so fun will return to old Superman and his pals, but how did we get this far? That's a good question.
I think, you know, one of the things we've noted, not just us, but other people have noted that, you know, DC has found, they've decided this is what we're going to do. You know, you complain about the internet all you want, but this is what we're going to do. You know, they brought back these 90s creators. One of the things they said when New 52 launched was they wanted to bring back all the people from the 90s that left comics. And so they're going that way. And I think it's stylistically the way they're doing it too. I mean, they're very... The costumes are very busy and overwrought, and there's a lot of angst. And I think they're going for that 90s vibe to try to recapture that 90s audience.
Do you think The Dark Knight has anything to do with it? I mean, when they were talking about let's do movies this way, and I thought, I don't know, maybe it's just taken this long for it to happen.
Like, I really don't think it is. I really think it's. I think. Really? It's, I think. It, I mean, I don't. I'm just guessing. I could be wrong. You could be right. But it seems to me a very concerted effort to recreate 90s comics. And so I think that's where it comes from. But that's just me.
Yeah, I just think it's that. And they decided that, you know, I think it's a top-down thing. Like they said that we're going to do this. And that's why they don't have the triumvirate. I don't know who makes the decision in that. But Bob Harris as EIC and then Jim Lee and Dan Didio as co-publishers. And then Jeff Johns as whatever he is, chief creative officer, I think.
They basically backwards.
Did I?
So the power structure is the opposite way.
Yeah, no, I get that. But the point is, whatever they decided, I feel like, and there's a lot of stuff being handed down to editors to just say, this is, we're going to write in this style. We're going to write
That's what editors in chief should
do. It's true.
Do.
And that's, you know, what some people have asked for. And they have. And it's a tone. And the thing is, if you're not into that tone, then, you know, maybe this isn't the stuff for you, where you're not seeing nearly as many divergences as you do over at Marvel. Now, he mentioned, you know, Adventures of Superman, Batman 66, some of the stuff being done digitally first. I think those are where you're going to see – I bet they're paying less for those page rates and things.
Oh, definitely.
Not the books. So that's why those are able to happen over there, so they can spend less money on those experiments, I guess. You're seeing a lot less sort of diversity than you do at Marvel in style.
Also, a bunch of those digital books are ending soon.
Yeah.
Mm. So the big question I think of right now, Batman 66 by Jeff Parker. He also did the first Adventures of Superman. He's going to be moving to the print Aquaman. Is that going to be fun?
That's what we'll see. But I really do think it's an editorial edict to do this kind of story, to do this teeth gnashing. I mean, I think you nailed it with the Damien description. It felt like a book from 1992, and there's a lot of angsty posing and teeth gnashing, and it just, I think that's what they're going for. They want to reclaim that audience that is never coming back, and it's been 2 years, we know they're not coming back, and, you know, but that seems to be, we're going to do this, and we're going to stick with it, and it makes the money, so.
That's the thing. Like, in the end, the market's going to support that. There were a bunch of different books at the beginning of the start of this, and all of them that were different got axed. So everything is in lockstep, and, you know, people supported Villains Month. They sold a lot of books.
They had the best month of any publisher ever since they've been measuring these things.
I also think about the depiction of Crypto in that Superboy cover I posted a while ago, and how he looks like a saber-toothed cat, and you put that next to, juxtapose that with just a few years ago, Francis Manipal drawing Crypto as this loving, loyal pet in Smallville and Adventure Comics. And I miss that a lot.
I think that's what we're doing.
Yep. If you want to write in, you can write to contact@fanboy.com, or you can call a voicemail at 888-FANBOYS, which is 326-2697. You guys got anything to...
Quick plug, the upcoming Thor the Dark World podcast is upcoming. How's that for
perfect.
A redundant plug? The movie comes out next week, and some form of our group will be talking about it. We don't know yet. We don't know exactly. We haven't talked about it amongst ourselves, but... as always, there will be a podcast about Thor the Dark World, which I'm very excited for.
And very quickly, the next Booksplode is going to be Doctor Strange the Oath by Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin.
Cool.
So it'll be in a few weeks.
Where do they go, Connor?
I was looking at Amazon to purchase myself a copy of something that we were talking about earlier. You go to ifanboy.com to comment on the show, find out all the other podcasts we've got going on. You can comment on those. You can talk about the books of the week you read. You don't have to talk about the books we talked about. You can talk about whatever happened this week in comics under the podcast. You can follow everything at twitter.com/ifanboy, facebook.com/ifanboy.
Like I said, we have more voicemail and email. We just ran out of time this week. But if you want to add to it, we can always use good questions at contact@fanboy.com or leave a voicemail at 888-FANBOYS, which is 326-2697.
And if you dig us, write us a review on iTunes, or better yet, tell your friends about us. Introduce your mom to podcasts. Spread all that iFanboy love.
Sweet.
I don't know what happens to my Beatles anthology book.
I have two of them because we got married.
Well, I think the opposite problem is I think it got lost in my parents' divorce. I don't know where it went.
That's unfair that they would take your book away from you.
Well,
that's a mean judge.
All the books went away, and I need to buy a new copy.
I have an extra one.
Maybe you need to send me your extra copy.
Yeah, I might be able to.
That's what friends do, Josh.
All right. Say goodbye.
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 Goodbye.